Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher have been joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, and podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's the Green Party candidate for South Dunedin, and therefore, to comply with the Electoral Act, he can't be here tonight, and me, Samuel Mann, who isn't standing and therefore can be here tonight. Tonight's guest, who also isn't standing for election, is Stephen Blythe from the Kapiti Coast. He supports Tangata Whenua community and volunteer organisations to make use of the web. He's in Dunedin representing Net Squared.
That's right, yes. It's a movement of groups run by volunteers that are helping people learn about technology from each other.
Sounds good. Now, you're from Kapiti Coast, but you're originally from Dunedin.
Yes, I grew up over in Tainui, Anderson's Bay, went to Tainui School, and went to Bayfield School before family returned to Christchurch, where I went on to further study and life's adventures in the north.
So what did you do after leaving school?
I first became an editor of the student newspaper after completing my university studies. I was the editor of the student newspaper at Canterbury for a year, and I couldn't decide what to do after that. I thought, I'm not going to follow everyone else and go to the UK. I'll spend some time in the Pacific Islands. I read in a Lonely Planet book that you could travel by yacht to the islands by being a crew member. So I packed my bag, hitchhiked to Whangarei, and was on a yacht, and I sailed to Tonga, and I stayed in the Pacific Islands for 3 months.
That sounds nice. Mm. What was your degree on?
I've studied politics and history at the first time around, yeah.
Cool. And what led you to that?
I actually went to university because I wanted to be a journalist. I've been a writer and interested in news and stuff for many, many years when I was a child and growing up as a boy in Dunedin. But I got to university and I got some ratbag Marxist-influenced academics. My mind got turned off mainstream media and I decided not to pursue learning how to be a journalist. And I just decided to get involved in being involved in change, I guess. Hmm.
What needs to change? We've got an hour.
That's great. Yeah. So I guess even from back then, there's a large number of people on the planet. We're a finite planet. The quality of life that we're experiencing is very, very, very different in different parts of the world and even within our own countries. I kind of believe that everyone could have a good life with rewarding work, healthy families, and an environment which is sustained for all our future generations. But unfortunately, we seem to be trapped in a pattern which is going against the inbuilt and inherent care that we as humans have for other people. So what has to change is actually quite a lot, but in a way, it's actually getting back to living out some of the human values which have been brushed over in what I'd consider a very materialistic, individualistic society. Yeah,
the good life that you just described sounds quite appealing.
Of course, yeah. I think it's not about doing without, and people have shown that some of the countries that have the least amount of resources have incredible well-being, and the richness comes from being part of a community. I'm not entirely, I don't know all about the methodology of the Global Happiness Index or the Unhappiness Index as it's sort of been described, but the countries that come out on top are the likes of Vanuatu and Costa Rica. Well, they don't have high GDP, but the welfare of the people is actually high, and as with the environment. But so I think the way that we live, highly urbanized, driving everywhere, thinking that we can our happiness comes from buying things and sales, it doesn't gel to me.
So. I met some people once at a conference from Costa Rica, and they were doing some really interesting things in terms of education for sustainability. And I was coming back and talking about what they were doing. And I found that people were really engaged about these people and how they had taken this approach to, similar to what we're doing at the Polytech, every graduate thinking and acting as a sustainable practitioner. I can't remember exactly how they were describing it. And people would listen until I said that they came from Costa Rica. Mm. And at that point, it was like, well, they're sort of like third world. We don't care what they're doing. Tell us about what people are doing in Sweden. So we've got this kind of like inbuilt, we only want to know what we have this pre-inbuilt model of the things that we'll follow. Why is that?
We bring, I guess, a lot of assumptions about our canons of knowledge. And all through our schooling and particularly university life, the canons go back to Roman thinkers and stuff like that. So we tend to, I guess, see them as the people that give us our intellectual foundations. I recall having a lecturer when I was doing second year. I thought about politics, and I thought I'd better get a good grounding in Aristotle and Saint Augustine and all these characters. And we had a Canadian lecturer, and he kept bewailing us Kiwis for not having a good understanding of the basics of Greek and Latin and Roman, early Roman culture. And it's like, you know, we struggle enough learning about our own country, let alone those canons. So I think our education system is sort of inbuilt, many inbuilt biases. And for the people who can offer different worldviews, different perspectives, really got to fight. So even in New Zealand, the depth of recognition that we have in the notions of stewardship or guardian, you know, the kaitiakitanga that Māori can offer us, well, does that really get taught to people? And many of the other concepts that could benefit us, rather than those from the sort of Western individualist canon, which I think are taking us down a path which is incredibly destructive. Yeah.
Do we have to be individualistic? Like, we need to earn money, we need to eat. Do we need to have that sort of, you know, we can talk about all this sort of like good stuff about working together and all that sort of stuff, but we still need to get money into our own wallets, don't we?
I think the way that life is structured at the moment, of course, that's the choice we are presented. One of the writers who I saw him speak in Christchurch many years ago, called Ted Trainer. He's a sustainability thinker, thinking about development initiatives of justice. He actually had an idea. I doubt it was a novel one. Many others probably talked about it. In fact, I do know if someone else has talked about it. But actually, it was the idea of we could survive by living off, by earning 20, by working 20 hours. And what we needed for cash to pay for things, if we structured our society a bit differently, and the benefits that would come from that, and the strength that would come from the time that we'd have to be involved in things in our community, whether it's visiting elderly people, doing community projects together, being more involved in school. Like in recent years, the men's shed, they've really taken off. Why is it only people, they tend to be seen for people that are in their senior part of life, but why don't we have resources like that available for all people who want to be part of it and the time to create things? We've got sucked into this idea that we have to buy our way out of everything. And I think the recent movements, I guess, of the maker spaces where people are making stuff together, and they've got 3D printers and other technologies as reclaiming the idea that we can, we're not dependent on buying things all the time. I think another part of that is the gift economy and people choosing to gift time or to gift surpluses. It's just that we have allowed ourselves to think that working 40 hours a week and or more, we have a very uneven distribution of work, and then we have people without work, but that is the norm. If we really deeply sat down and thought about it, is that as satisfying as it could be for an individual? And does there some richness, some other benefits come by being part of an active community? So should I just mention that the New Economics Foundation in the UK have also been advocating quite recently in the last 5 years for the notion of a 20-hour work week? Partly this has come about after the financial crisis, and there's a lot of essentially a wasted generation and a lot of talented people where there's not enough paid work as we conceive it, but we've got talented, fit people who can work, but it's just that we've structured them out by composing work in a certain way, and their argument is to allow more people to work, but we work less.
At the end of these conversations, we ask people three questions, the last one of which is, do you have any advice for listeners? So sneak preview of the questions coming up at the end. Yeah. The most common answer that we get is people say words to the effect of, get involved.
Mm.
And a couple of weeks ago, Jan Logie, the Green MP, she's standing in your electorate, I believe, she said it's not only is it worthwhile getting involved, but you actually feel better when you're active about something that you really want to get engaged in. Is that what you see? Is it a, you know, we can all work together and actually feel better together?
I think so, yeah. And in fact, there's a poster out there from the Mental Health Foundation, and they've identified five ways that you can improve your mental health well-being, and one of them is connectedness, and it's about participation. So I definitely see that, and I think particularly because gifting and being involved in community things is often a more open and accepting. It's not about performing in a certain level or a certain set of expectations. People can give as they're able, and that allows people to participate on their own terms as opposed to having to fit a certain set of criteria. And also to be often in a workplace, and I've experienced this myself, the work is about you as the skills and the experience that you bring, but not you. You sort of have to leave yourself at the door and come and be the brainy person or the muscle or the the peacemaker, whatever your skill may be, but the sort of the fuller complexity of your life. So I think in a community setting, you can be more yourself.
But it's undervalued.
Oh, totally, yeah.
And lots of the services that you would think would be the most important services in the city are being run out of essentially volunteer organisations in the very building that we're in. Why are we valuing or not valuing those important services?
I'd have to say it's a bigger level. It's a structural thing. It's not about individual choices and I guess it's decision makers, and there's an elite that is benefiting from the structure as it is. Some people were doing very well out of the way that the society is structured at the moment with its great inequality. So there's an inbuilt inertia and an inbuilt set of incentives for a certain group of people to maintain things as they are. At the moment, because there's not a lot of profit assigned to much of the work of people working to tangata whenua community and voluntary sector, it's not seen as lucrative. It's not been sort of monetized, which I actually think is a good thing as long as we can retain a different way of doing things. We don't all have to become mini businesses. So I think that's partly about, I guess, a political dynamic. And I think it's all partly about an economic system where we've... we kind of held ourselves hostage to a set of assumptions that a healthy society is about growth. If we don't keep growing, if the banks stop investing in New Zealand, what if all of a sudden society is going to collapse as we know it? So we don't, and we're part of this international thing, and New Zealand's reputation would be marred and everything. It's very difficult to step away from an economic system that we've invested so much in. So I guess when people do things differently, they get shunned. Cuba's probably the most extreme example where they chose to do things in a different way. I'm not talking like, because totalitarianism isn't great either. I'm not sort of an advocate for that, but of course, who would be?
David Clark at the Child Poverty panel, which was in Dunedin a couple of weeks ago, said that in conclusion, he said that the measure of society is how we look after the most vulnerable. I'm sure he didn't think that up. I've heard that somewhere before, but it is a powerful statement. I mean, here's a politician standing for election, and that's the bit he's leaving us with. Yeah, I'm just still trying to get my head around. It's not lucrative. Does that matter? I mean, you say that it's perhaps good that some of those things aren't monetized.
Of course, because I think when things become purely about something that you ascribe a monetary value to, it's like you can pay it off. It's almost like you do some harm. Okay, well, that harm is described as being costing $1,000. I will pay the $1,000 and I will make the harm. It's a false. The harm still exists. So I also think there's a deeply embedded competitiveness in that. And okay, we're going to get back to a discussion about are humans innately competitive or cooperative. My sense would be that there's more on the cooperation side, and that there's an ideology that makes us think that competition is the key set of values. So I guess in my work, if I was successful, in the things that I do, I want to encourage more cooperation and more people coming together to do things in a way where the individuals and individual values and their value, and the things they stand for are respected, but people can come to a common place. So,
do you think that the notion of the volunteer is abused? And I'm thinking about things like the Rugby World Cup. It had an army of volunteers, and those people did great work. I'm not saying that they didn't, and the community benefited from it. But it was also a money-making venture. And I
don't know. So I've learned. I work in the same office in Wellington part-time as volunteer in New Zealand. And this is with an organisation called Tangata Whenua Community and Voluntary Research. We promote research done by the sector itself. And so I sat next to Vanessa, who's the CEO of Volunteer in New Zealand. And we wanted to get community research, wanted to get a volunteer recently. And I said, oh, it's been a while since I've, formally got a volunteer. What should I ask? What would be the thing? And she said, straight up, without any hesitation, what's their motivation? So I think it's the key thing to understand is what motivates people. And maybe there were some tasks in that example, the World Cup that you talked about, where maybe it would have been better to pay people. But sometimes people want to be involved in something that's big, and there's some rewards that go with it. And there's some acknowledgement, and that people are looked after. So maybe looking outside, it looks like maybe, I don't know, but off possibly, but actually it's the motivation. My dad actually volunteered, put his hand up to volunteer. They weren't able to play games in Christchurch, of course, so I don't think he ended up doing volunteering, but he was just keen to be part of it.
So there's that motivation, isn't it?
Yeah, he also volunteers, say, on the golf tournament. So he's been down to Arrowtown with my mum, and they do the volunteering, mum's scoring and dad's driving people around. He likes to be involved, you know, and it's meeting people, gets a chance to get out of town. You know, like there's quite a lot of different motivations. So I think it's more if people are abusing the goodwill of volunteers or doing it in a way where really they're not looking after the volunteers, or they're doing it in a way where really they used to have a budget, they decided not to use the budget for that, and the volunteer gets all these basically shit jobs. and it's not really a very fair thing, but I think that's relatively rare, yeah.
So one of the things that you've done in your CV is you were helping to run ECO for a while.
That's right, yeah.
Remind us what ECO is.
Environment and Conservation Organisations. It's an umbrella of real grassroots conservation and environment groups. And it does, at the time that I was working, I'm a little out of touch. I included some of the big ones like Greenpeace and those other big ones as well. Yeah.
Is that a motivation for you in that environmental area?
Definitely. I actually came to the environment stuff when I was studying at university, and I joined the University of Canterbury Tramping Club, and I remember going on some great walks with the tramping club, and I thought, man, this environment is a pretty precious thing. And then seeing there's an environment group on campus. So I joined the University of Canterbury Environment Group, which I hope is still going. And with these things, you put your hand up. Someone who's been there 1 year longer than you sees you put your hand up. So the year later, you know, I'm on the committee, and the year later, you know, we're running the standard orientation week and so on. So I've got a long track record in both volunteering and sort of doing environmental stuff.
Did you see then, how did you describe the situation? Are we in a crisis? Is that a word you use?
Back then?
Yeah.
At that time, this was in the early 90s, late 80s, there was a massive explosion of interest in the environment. It was seemed to be at a tipping point of sort of real action. There just seemed to be one big issue after another that it's like people can't but take notice. And particularly in a couple of years later, it was the French decision to resume testing in the Pacific.
And you'd spent time in the Pacific?
Yeah.
What were you doing for ECO?
Okay, for the first 3 years, I actually was the paid worker. It's a very small organization. I had one worker and a couple of project workers from time to time. So back in the day, I was licking stamps actually to send the newsletter out. I think we'd got rid of the Gestetner, which many people may not have heard of, but that's an old reproduction thing where you have one in your office and you do it by hand. Membership, you know, the looking after the committee and stuff. And then after 3 years, I had a change, but I decided to go on the committee because I wanted to be more involved in the policy stuff. So, and also, I guess, organizational development from a different point of view. So I was involved in many of the regular conferences and the newsletter and helping appoint staff and all those sorts of things to help keep an organization ticking over.
And so then by the early 2000s, you were setting up or helping set up CommunityNet?
Yeah, actually that came about in 1998. I worked for the Department of Internal Affairs, and as well as giving out lottery grants, or they administer lottery grants, and they run the COGS funding, and they run some other funding projects. They actually have a role supporting information provision to community organisations. And a colleague of mine, Margie Scotts, had been in Australia, and she got stuck on a bus next to this guy, Gary Hardy, and he was running a service supporting Victorian community groups to get access to information called VicNet. By the end of that bus ride to the conference, I think it took about 5 hours, she said, I've got to go back to New Zealand and help community groups use this thing called the web. That was in 1997. So she wrote a strategy, which the Department of Internal Affairs put a very modest amount of money in. And we built the CommunityNet Aotearoa website, basically without anyone having any real clue about what we were doing.
What was the vision then?
That community groups would be empowered by the internet to get information, to be able to work together, to maybe, I don't know if we articulated the idea of maybe working smarter, but in my interest really, I guess it builds, I talked before about being a newspaper editor, and I saw the internet as a great tool because getting your word into print and finding an audience was pretty difficult. I thought the web would be a great tool for people to tell their story.
But at that time, that's before Web 2, the sort of the audience participation,
yeah.
if you like, and the user-generated content. So how were you seeing it then as an empowerment tool and not just as a cheaper form of printing?
Basically, at those days, your choice was set up a website, and then anyone could believe that they could do it themselves. So the idea that you could get the code a website, everyone learned HTML, did very, very basic. And I showed a picture in the talk today of the website CommunityNet from 2001, and nowadays you cringe when you see it. So I guess really, it's possibly a little naive that the idea that you could merely put information in front of people, because we didn't really know that the discussion tools were there, but they were pretty basic. But I guess the idea that you could have some discussion around topics and people could suggest ideas, that it wasn't limited to us controlling it. So we use very basic ways of doing that at the moment. So actually on those web pages the picture of the CommunityNet from 2001 I showed today, you could submit a job post, you could do all sorts of things. So we did what we could, it seemed possible. We didn't rely on the web alone. We actually brought all the community advisors into some training so that they could then support training of community groups. And we were involved in some policy stuff. So we kind of tried to look at it in a full picture of things here. And at some point, we wrote a book of case studies, just all the sort of usual stuff you do when you've got something new to bring on board. Yeah.
What was the uptake like?
I feel it was still around today. It's got a very good reputation, so on some levels it's really good. Over time, it evolved and it's continued to evolve. A new version of it just came out earlier this year. What do people like? Well, when you go to set up a new organization, who wants to go through all the trouble of writing every single clause for your constitution out? Well, we put things like that on there, so there were templates. The number of downloads, it was almost astounding. I thought, oh, man, surely not this many groups are being set up in that period of time. But people were really accessing quite practical resources to run their organizations. Yeah, I think.
Did you get any backlash? Was there anybody that said, no, we don't want to do that, that's not what we're about?
Never vocalised. Basically, people may have turned their backs and thought it wasn't relevant. And I've subsequently been involved in other projects that are working in the same sort of idea of empowering people working in community and voluntary sector groups. One was called Community Research. It was funded from another government fund. And the idea was basically to have a meeting place online where community groups could come and have a little meeting space, basically. Send out emails to everyone, store some files and stuff. And it was launched in, I think, 2008 or 9. It was closed down within a year. It just didn't have the level, even at that point, the level of activity. Like, people weren't saying that's a neat something that wasn't meeting a real need. So same issues apply today. If you've got a successful website, it's because you've done a lot of homework. You're engaging your audience in what you put up there. You're looking at the analytics, seeing what's popular. You're involving people, you know, like, so there's kind of some recipes that you can, or processes really, that you can use to get it right.
Do you think it's the same recipes for community groups as it might be if you were trying to sell something?
Probably very similar, actually, yeah.
So it's about engaging and giving a reason to go there, that sort of thing?
I think so. Like, our attention is really limited. I don't know about you, but the number of things that I could possibly, I'm interested in a lot of stuff. So for a community group actually to reach someone, particularly like it's very easy to access things. And I think the bit by bit, the notion of people being loyal to one organization only, like, it's slow, it's beginning to pass away. It's definitely a trend that people have written about in the States. So people aren't signing up, I'm going to sign up for this and I'll give all my money to them for all my working life. It's more, oh, I like this cause now, jump on to the next one. So to really be remain visible in front of people, you've got to find a way to hook them in. And while that will use some of the same techniques that maybe people who are trying to sell things are doing, it's if you don't have the ethics in a good perspective in place, that's going to go sour pretty quickly. So I think you, yeah.
Do you think that reduces, though, the environmental organisations into, I'll say it anyway, manipulating, but having to,
yeah,
not in a bad way. Are they having to put more effort than they should have to just into managing that sort of social interaction?
Well, probably let's break the audience in half. And one thing about that, you've got a lot of loyal people and they're really interested and they will probably read everything you do. Okay, so we've got loyal people and they might become agents and change on your behalf. So you actually want to bring them through and help them become more active. Well, you can't do that passively. You can't just, like, to be honest, when I worked at Eco, I found we really struggled to have the creativity to have a really sparkly newsletter. It's very hard when you're on limited resource and the newsletter's done because we've got to get it out because we've got to notice and, you know, those sorts of things. So, but you do have to, you've got to appeal to people, and it's not just about ideas. And I think that's one of the traps that people who believe in good causes, that they actually think if only people understood the rational logic of the ideas about the parts per million or the concentration of this, that would win people over. But it's actually also about your heart. So if you don't attend to both, you're going to be problem. And that includes your core supporters. Don't think you have to work as hard for them. And then there's the other group. It's the people that you want to bring on board who are concerned about what they're reading in the news, their friends are talking about, they see a billboard and stuff, and they're kind of exploring, giving expression to their concern. And you might have to, if your organization is about bringing on new people, well, you probably have to work a bit harder to get them on board. You can't go from being, I picked up your brochure. No, I didn't sign up to give you money on the street. Go away. But I got your brochure, and I'll take it home and read it. And they look on the website to suddenly them getting a 40-page document about the perils of, deep sea fishing. You know, it's too big a leap. So I think paying attention to your audience is pretty important.
And sometimes using gimmicks to get their attention.
I think so. But again, if you bring more of an ethical point of view, it's a play. I'd say that maybe that's playful, and it's a way of engaging people that actually gets people's attention. And maybe a laugh and smile is vital. if we're browbeaten into being involved in things, who's going to last? I certainly, my own choices in terms of what I do in my volunteering, I know there's a lot of bad stuff, but I choose to do things which I feel will give me energy to carry on. And one of the things that I really don't like is long meetings. So I tend not to be involved in those sorts of – if it's just a choice I've made. So everyone has a threshold about how they want to be involved. So,
Yeah, I was just thinking about Greenpeace has got that polar bear that's appearing all over the place at the moment, and I saw somewhere something saying, you know, why don't you just take things seriously or work on it? And I interviewed Nathan Argent from Greenpeace. In fact, I interviewed one heads up for another question that's coming up. Are you an activist? I ask everybody if an activist, and most people say no. Oh yes, no. It's the bit afterwards that's really important. But he and quite a lot of people say, I'm an activist, but I'm not like a Greenpeace activist. He said, I'm an activist, but I'm not a Greenpeace activist, despite the fact he is a Greenpeace activist, because he sees that his job is more about the sort of the policy level things, not climbing up oil rigs and things. But do we need both of those?
For sure. I don't know. In my heart, I feel very deeply that the planet is in amazing peril, and the and people are suffering, and we've got to do something. I take my leave, and I do. I go back to Warden Henry Thoreau and notions of civil disobedience, and I would say that Greenpeace it grows from a tradition of civil disobedience. I have a personal line on this, and I respect other people's choices, but I believe aggressive activity that harms others or could cause potential harm to others is a line where I struggle with. I can respect how people could think their way into that, and I think Greenpeace walk a very fine line, but on the whole, my perspective was that they don't go over that line into using tactics which to me, like ethically, put them in the side of not the side. I'm not really into sides, to be honest, but take them in. You know better than the people that you're trying to change. So I think they're very deliberate. They're incredibly experienced people. I've come here a little biased because I have been on the roof of the British Embassy at a Greenpeace protest back in the I've explored all sorts of ways of expressing my commitment to change, and I've been involved in other actions with them and other causes. So I respect carefully done with the ethics, you can do it.
Is it the same technology that's needed to support Greenpeace as it is to support the single cause, more local thing? Is it the same stuff?
I'm not sure. I don't know if it is. Greenpeace are trying to get critical mass, large numbers. They want many of the things they're doing to say, hey, look, we've got look how many New Zealanders are behind us. So they do a mix, of course, because they're down there on the coast, and I know the work that they've done with the pollution of the river near the mills in the North Island and the Bay of Plenty is about highlighting individual stories. But I think local groups are very much about the engaging in the real stories and in what's happening locally. And the numbers is probably not the thing. It's a much harder thing to do because you've got to have reach and you've got to actually have people. So Greenpeace have a team. A smaller group, I'd struggle to see how they could take it to scale. Yeah.
You talked earlier about getting attention, and it's not just about ideas. We interviewed four or five people from the Science Communication Conference last year, and very much it was about that notion of the story. Is the story and the facts opposite ends of a continuum, or is it somehow about bringing those two things together?
I think it's bringing it together, because somebody spots something they don't like happening in, a watercourse near them, and their intuitive perception is they see something brown and icky going down the river. It's observable. You know, and they take some action about it. And because it keeps happening again and again, and they're concerned about the impact, say, of that getting into their drinking water. So that is based on an observed, something that somebody's observed. And I think I'm all for citizens collecting, like citizens can collect information. But then maybe they say, hey, we've got to get we can't win because we're going to take this to the regional council to try and stop the source of that happening. And we actually need some evidence to back up our case, something that we're observing, because we're seeing something happen as a result of this and we are worried. So they are both totally valid. Like being worried about pollution or deforestation or, something even more abstract, because I think it's a pretty... Can we be worried about climate change when it's such an abstract thing? But why should we invalidate people feeling like we don't have to privilege one set of knowledge over another? Now, in certain and there are different types of knowledge, because if you think of a Māori worldview when it comes to water and a sacredness associated with water, like pollution is just abhorrent. based on that a spiritual view. So we've got to, I think we they're valid in my view. Yeah.
Now, in March this year, you went to a conference, the non-profit technology conference. Where was that? In Washington, D.C.?
Yes, I travelled to Washington. And for the last 2 years, I've been running a group in Wellington called NetSquared. We anyone interested in using social, using the web or technical tools for social change, and we happen to be one of 50 similar groups, active groups around the world, and the organization, we're kind of sponsored by TechSoup Global, and TechSoup give out software to charities, and they realize that giving away software alone isn't enough, and they really want to support people to make use of technology. And yeah, sure, you can go to a website, and they have a great TechSoup website, and you can go to some online learning and so on like that, but they like the idea of people meeting face-to-face. So they want that to be a strong network. It's been going for 6 years. When they asked last year, oh, is anyone around the world willing to just to be a cheerleader, an advocate for the NetSquared groups in your region, my hand shot up pretty fast. And they said as a condition of that, you must come to Washington to meet with the other NetSquared ambassadors. So the other NetSquared ambassadors, one woman came from Guatemala, Maria, and Excel, who works in the Cameroon and West Africa, was unable to get a visa to come to the States. So we missed him, but we did Skype him while we were together. And we had Mel from Cambridge in the UK. And we were supported by our ringleader who works full-time or virtually full-time for TechSoup. He came from Vancouver. So we met to talk about how we can make this movement, NetSquared, a strong one where people can learn about many of the things we've just been discussing. Yeah.
So this, I'm just looking through the conference guide that you've brought in. This is a big conference.
I was astounded. I have been to quite a few conferences in my time. I like to go and learn and network. There were 2,100 people at this event. It was just incredible, even just to navigate around and to work out where things were and not be disoriented. And it was inside a big convention center where there's actually no natural light. At one point, I became a little frustrated about just being stuck inside, and I thought, I've got to get outside. And I bumped into someone. I said, can we do a flash mob? This idea of people suddenly spontaneously come together and we'll do it for getting some vitamin D and going outside. So this is actually someone from TechSoup, and a few other people tweeted it out to the network, the 2,000 people there. Because at a conference like that, you have a main hashtag and multiple other hashtags in Twitter, which basically allow, if you want to follow what's going on, so it's called hashtag, the hash sign, 14NTC. So we sent the message out, come and meet us outside, get some sunshine. Well, guess who turned up? There were six of us, or seven, and they were all people that I'd personally asked. No one came because they saw it on a tweet. So, which meant everyone was focused on communicating and internet and kind of connecting with each other, not looking at their phones to following the tweets to see what other opportunities were cropping up.
It's interesting. Some conferences you go to and they put the hashtag up and you're the only person using it, and other times it takes off.
Well, in the States, this conference is not only big, but the organization, which I've been a member of the Nonprofit Technology Network for 5 years, only costs $90-odd a year to join, and I get a number of benefits out of it. Yeah, and they have 10,000 members. So I guess a larger population, when you get a lot of people together, and Twitter's and some of these other social media things are a bit more widely accepted, yeah, it's just part of how people do things. Yeah.
When they say non-profit, that's including in the States, that's like some of the big universities and things
that's
fit
right
into that same model. So we're not talking about, you know, somebody trying to regenerate a couple of hectares of penguins.
You'd be surprised. If you look in the program, there's 100-plus sessions. If you wanted to pick a track on practical things that a small organization could do, you could find them. So actually they do cater for a wide diversity of types of organizations. It's not, and a lot of it is about communication, which applies across, it doesn't really matter, to be honest, some of the things across size.
If you were talking to a small group, they've got themselves a website, they've had a website built in the first round of enthusiasm in the late 90s, do they need to update that, or can that, is that happily sitting there?
If you want to engage people in what you're doing, if you send out a print newsletter and you get people writing back and, you know, or emailing back or getting in touch with you saying, great, yes, we'd like to be part of that, or what about this idea? And part of your audience is online and they stopped getting print newsletters, I think it's very important to be online. If your audience isn't online, why be there? And I think just having enough of a presence. But if you know an important part of the people that you work for, your volunteers, your local community there, and it doesn't need to be elaborate. And I think this is what NetSquared is about. It's a very much a DIY, learn from each other sort of approach. It doesn't have to be a really high in flash. So I think a blog, to be honest, if you could write a blog post and then you can share it and you get a few comments on it and you're starting to write up what you're doing, it's a great start. I think video, simple videos, and they can actually just be about taking a series of photos together and maybe putting some captions on it, putting a bit of back music in the background. It depends what your computer you use. If it's Windows kind of computer, you'll have Movie Maker. If it's a Mac, you've got iMovie. There's open source equivalents to that. So put together some slides, put a narration on it. Like thinking that it's this massive hurdle that has to wait till you get the right person, I think that you could demystify that.
Do you suggest that people use open source? Is that a particular...
It's a bit like that you asked me before about volunteering. It's a mode of, you've kind of got to go where people are at to a degree. And I believe open source has very real strengths in some areas. And it's sort of like pushing against the flow in others. So, personally, I've tried Ubuntu, which is an operating system, and a variety of open source tools. I've ended up going back to Microsoft Word because I'm familiar with it, and it's got some tools that I couldn't find elsewhere. And although I think nowadays, like at that level, things are becoming very, very similar, there's enough difference that maybe switching, say you've got 3-4 people that you employ in an organization, or you've got one person who's very important in the organization, you say, we're going to switch, I think you create problems. So in some areas, if you've been talking about mapping something and you've got a unique idea and you think, gosh, we've looked around, we've hunted everywhere, we've looked on the N10 website and so on, we've tried to find a little bit of software for this purpose that's going to do this, and we want to start from scratch. And we think, oh, it can't only be us. If you're going to do that, I think working collaboratively and then sharing what you do with others so that they can benefit is definitely the way to go. Paying someone that they can then benefit from it and locking it up in a proprietary way. And I think somewhere in the middle, WordPress, common blogging platform, there's a number of other things like that where they are actually open source and people use that without really knowing. So
you would suggest that people use a content management system such as WordPress rather than starting from scratch?
Oh, Devin, absolutely nowadays, yeah. No doubt about it. You can have a 5-page website on WordPress. It has a famous 5-minute install. You can get hosting for $6 a month. Comes with a button you push. And to get the basics, then you want to change the colors and stuff like that. Well, it's a wee bit more work, but it's not hard. You can have it self-hosted on WordPress.com, where you don't even actually do an install. There are others, Weebly and another one. But I like open source, so I tend to go to WordPress.
So what do you actually do as the NetSquared ambassador?
Okay. In Australia and New Zealand, there are five or six active groups. There's one in Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney. We've just the one in Auckland has just been revived with someone, a couple of new co-organisers, and there's one in Wellington. So I'm basically just encouraging and a contact person to help the existing organisers. We're all co-organisers. We're all volunteers doing it to support our communities, and we can learn from each other. But if no one makes the time to set up a joint conference call, it won't happen. TechSoup support NetSquared quite well. They offer a free meetup platform which allows easy organisation of informal networks for RSVPing and event notifications and records and things. But they also have a little bit of a budget to support the co-organisers to meet. So I helped organise a gathering of co-organisers from Australia and New Zealand on the Gold Coast before the Connecting Up conference there, so I helped organise that. And my other part of the role, I guess a couple of other bits, trying to bring on anyone else, be a bit of an evangelist for this, what I think is a very good sort of movement. So talked in Christchurch yesterday, I've had a talk here today, I've talked to someone in Perth about setting up a meetup group, and we're trying to bring someone on board in Brisbane. So by the end of my reign, as I jest, which is going to go to the end of the year, I'm hoping maybe there'll be one more group, and the groups that are around feel well supported and active. Yeah. So
let's look at these questions that I promised. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Interesting. This has come up today. I was talking.
I know it was me about an hour, half an hour
no,
ago.
No, it wasn't. Somebody else talked about it. And actually, even if it's interesting, within NetSquared, we talk about change makers. And actually, I guess I have an activist sensibility in terms of critiquing and wanting to challenge, but because the word has sort of been tarred, I guess you'd say, and also my just at the stage, I've got young kids, I've got children, I've got a 5- and a 7-year-old. I'm investing much more time in family life, hoping. I wouldn't describe myself as an activist at the moment. I've definitely had my moments. In the past, change maker.
What challenges do you have for the next couple of years?
Well, to be honest, I think the biggest thing is fighting both apathy and cynicism. The challenges that we face are so huge. It worries me deeply, and especially as a father. What world are we creating for our children? So, to be honest, my own sense of whether I can make a change. So, I involve myself in things that will reward me and give me energy to keep on being involved. And as long as I'm still in the fray in the smallest way, I'll be happy. I know that my life ebbs and flows, as everyone's does. There's times for rest and renewal, and there's times where energy is diverted. So I wish to stay positive and to surround myself by people that have that sense of positivity so that we can bring about the change, many of the changes that we so deeply need. Yeah.
Do you have any advice for listeners?
Well, I guess it's apropos that last comment. Pretty easy to maybe feel a bit pessimistic, but I think allow yourself time. I think, basically, be kind. Be kind to yourselves. I'm sensing people, if you've listened this far, you're going to be pretty dedicated to a sense of change and making and you know your life's work. We all come, we all go. So it's not ever whatever we want to achieve won't be achieved in our own lifetime. So just, be gentle and also try and have a bit of fun. Like making the change that we want to see isn't about just the ideas and the rational things. It's we've got to bring. our full selves to this, and not just our intellects, I guess. So allow yourself to have fun. And, I guess I'm saying that because I haven't always, in some of my activism, I haven't always found that, or my community work. But now I cherish that because the actual time that I've got to do some of the work I most want to is very precious. So I want to live that.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, when he's not standing for election, and me, Samuel Mann. Tonight's guest was Stephen Blythe, who's finished by telling us to have fun, and I'm sure we have had fun for the past hour. It's been a really, really interesting conversation. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we're building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates people and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. You can follow the links on Sustainable Lens to find us on Facebook and various other places to keep in touch, and you can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes as well. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann, and I hope you enjoyed the show.